Yes. Well, this is like with meditation. It's a very natural state, but the conditioning is so strong that the cultural conditioning, the emotional habits that we ignore it. So it's learning to recognize it more, because like when life gets in peak moments, it's just natural, you know, like in. Or like when your life is in danger, physical danger, there's an intuitive awareness that is quite natural to that. But in ordinary life, we tend to, you know, get caught up into anxiety, worry, compulsive habits, and so we forget it. So like this in meditation, is this word meditation is used for everything. You know, it's got a mental training of some sort. But when I use the word, I mean this awareness, beginning to recognize it. So you like basic meditation techniques usually are around mindfulness of the breath or just recognizing the experience of the body as you're sitting, standing, walking, or lying down. So you're kind of bringing attention to what's very obvious in the present. So like when we start teaching meditation to people, you usually start with awareness of breath and the body. Because these things are always here and now. You're always breathing and your body is whatever, it's like this now. So you... And so these are kind of grounding practices. And then more and more you become, from there, as you establish awareness on the breath and the body, then you also become more aware, say, of the mood, that's the mental quality you're experiencing. So you know if you're, if you're calm or you're agitated or you're feeling... confused or clear, whatever, there's awareness, you know, you're using this awareness and recognize the emotional quality that's present. And so the more you kind of take, but to do this, it's you're using this awareness, this intuition, it's an intuitive intelligence to recognize the breath is like this, the body is like this, the mood is like this. So it's not discriminating, but it's discerning. So you can bring into, you know, just where, say, if you form a lot of views about, like people, Western people, when they approach meditation, oftentimes have strong opinions and views about it. And so they're always trying to make themselves fit into achieve something that they've read in a book or heard from somebody else. So they like in the old days, and we'd read these books and we want to get the samadhi in there. So we'd put this samadhi on as some kind of attainment that we wanted to get. So our practice was to get some kind of samadhi, some kind of peaceful mental state. And so, you know, sometimes you could, you know, if the conditions would allow it, you'd have it, and then much of the time the conditions wouldn't allow it, so you never got it, you know, you both feel this sense of despair. Until it began to dawn on me that wasn't what the Buddha was pointing to, you know, it was not attainment, but in this awakened awareness. So and this integrates also into your ordinary life. So the more you begin to recognize or trust yourself with intuition, then you just in, you know, in your daily life, in your work or with your family, whatever, then you're more aware of what you're feeling and the conditions around you and the feelings and the atmosphere that you're living in, without it getting into kind of criticism or self-criticism or criticism of others. It's a generous state of being. So it's not saying you shouldn't feel this way. It's just feeling this way is like this. So it's more learning to trust your, you know, to recognize that in yourself. To notice it and really make, you know, to value this ability, because some when it does happen sporadically, then we, you know, it's you know, it's very good, but also we tend to see it as some kind of special experience, you know, maybe due to some special conditions. So we identify it maybe being in the standing by a waterfall or on top of a mountain or something. And so we don't appreciate it as a natural state of being that is with us all the time, once we begin to realize it or recognize it. Because the conditioning is always taking us to extremities. When you look at your life, you see that you know, emotionally we're primed for extremity. You know, success or failure, good health, bad health, praise and blame. We want interesting life or excitement, romance, adventure. We want highs. We want to be happy. And so, you know, we spend our lives seeking happiness or you know, exciting adventures. And then the ordinariness of life is just dismissed as a kind of worthless, not bothering with. We live for these moments, these peak moments when we reach the top of Mount Everest or something like that. and the ordinary life can be ignored. Where the Buddha is putting the emphasis on the ordinariness of life rather than the peak moments. So like in a monastery, you know, like a Buddhist monastery, it tends to move toward ordinariness rather than extremity. So like the Buddha was, when he established the monastic order, he didn't want it to become an ascetic order, you know, like where you spend your time, you know, torturing yourself, sleeping on a bed of nails, wearing a hair shirt, fasting, and that, because that takes you to extremity of denial and pain. And then, or the other, of just seeking pleasure, finding happiness, always looking for happiness. But this they call the middle way. So in the monastic life, usually they're trying to, it's around kind of routine, ordinary things, eating your food, putting on your robes, walking from here to your room, or in Thailand, you know, on the Bindabat, I mean, you go in the villages in the morning to collect food. And so the mindfulness is around just the movement and flow of monastic life. And that helps, you know, because it's something you do every day. So the life in a Buddhist monastery tends to be very, well, in worldly terms, quite boring, because it doesn't lead or encourage, just move to extremity, to extreme experiences, or seeking excitement. But in spite of it all, this monastic life can be rather exciting too. But that's not his purpose. Does that help? It's like what I'm really trying to say is learning to trust yourself more, because that's, even though that might sound rather strange, I find that people don't, In the Western world, very much, we're self-critical. We tend to be self-critical, so we never trust our own, our own experience. And when we can just be stubborn and just believe we're right, and regardless of what anybody else says, that's not what I'm saying. But learning to recognize this in yourself, this awareness, it's simple and it's subtle. But it's not a contrived state. It's not something that you have to have perfect conditions to have. You can have it in the middle of a battlefield, wherever, whatever happening. But it's just learning to recognize it, and then really valuing that. So you're giving it. We tend to dismiss it. Because we give our value to the extremity, to the big moment, to the success, or to the failure, or to, the holiday, or the top of Mount Everest, and then that's where we're always looking into the future for the next exciting moment or the next big thing in our life, rather than just calming down, contentment is the kind of essence of monastic life, where you find contentment with very little and with just the life, monastic quality of life. And then once that you have some contentment, then you can Then you have some perspective then on all these kind of ways that one gets restless or discontented. So I remember I have this when I lived in London in 77, somebody sent me a postcard, and it was a cartoon of an old man. Looking out of a window, of a sash window in a kind of Victorian building, but all you see is this sash window and then the bricks of the building and then a garden, English kind of garden, and these kind of and the rain's falling down on the flowers, and the old man's holding a mug of coffee, looking out at the rain falling on the flowers. And so, coming to England then, this is, all the kind of trauma of moving out of Thailand and into London and all the confusion and expectations that both I had and everyone else had of me and so forth, it seemed to be overwhelming. So I used this little cartoon figure. I still have it in my kuti. To say, all you have to do is drink your coffee and watch the rainfall. And so I found that very comforting. So then over the years, the things, the kind of pressures and the things develop and expand, and then they start falling apart, and then people say you're great, and then they don't like you anymore, and on like this. You go through whole, cycles of experience. So all I have to do is just look out the window at the rain falling, drink my coffee, and let. And so it just keeps me from getting caught in jumping for joy when everything's going well and getting really miserable when things start looking bad and falling apart. Because then I find contentment in the life. So I find, it's like the monastic reflections, we have the four requisites. So we have, the Buddha, when he established the monastic order, he said, well, you have to have four things to survive. You have to have a shelter, to keep the rain off, you have to have something to wear, you have to have food, and you have to have medicine when you're ill. So he allowed, you know, he allowed us to have a shelter for one night, you know. So not, we don't have to own property or own a house or a kuti or anything. Just, and for monks, it's even the shelter of a tree, root of a tree, or rag robes. You know, the idea that, notice these are made in like patches, but the original robe allowance was just taking refuse cloth that was just thrown away. And the monks could take this cloth that nobody wanted to make some kind of covering for themselves. So you're living at a very low level of material. you know, the kind of throwaways or the rubbish of the society. And then food, they take what people give, you know, on alms round and whatever. So then you contemplate that to where you realize, like in my monastic life, people have been incredibly generous. So I have this nice little hut over here somebody built for me, you know, but I still reflect on it as a shelter for the night rather than, you know, saying this is mine. And even though sometimes emotionally I can feel this is mine, that's not the one I'm going to find contentment with. You know, it's more gratitude as it's a shelter for tonight. And then it's that gives me a sense of gratitude and contentment rather than thinking, I want this, you know, I want the English Sangha Trust to write to guarantee that this is mine the rest of my life. That's not a peaceful mental state, you know, if I should follow that one. Or food, take what, you know, like the food we get is very, you know, high quality. But more or less take whatever I get rather than demand special things. And the robes and the medicine in England, you get, you know, all kinds of benefits. So this is a kind of reflection that I can always use to feel this contentment. And then I see when I get discontent is where I'm not discontent around the four requisites, or that I can feel discontented about the personalities or the way things are happening here, or, you know, monks disrobing or this happening, or problems in the Sangha and all the stuff that goes on, you know, in the world. And one can feel very kind of resentful or ill at ease or angry about things like that. So this is where the keeping to that four requisite standard helped me to realize the value of this contentment, or this old man just content with watching the rain fall, or just the fact, you know, that I have becoming simple-minded. I've got a shelter for the night, roof over my head, thank you. And then the rest that I can deal with, you know, like the storms of life or the problems of the society or of members of the Sangha. So it's a difficult one, because we're living in a culture where contentment is not a virtue. You know, the capitalist system would fall apart if everybody in England became contented. I think we might be the real enemy of the... I mean, capitalism and modern economies depend on making you discontented, keeping you always, never, you know. Last year's model is not good enough. Kevin?
What would be
Well, that's, yeah, like I no longer believe anything that I think. You know, the stuff that comes up. So, because I realize that it's a habit. So, I mean, it's like you develop emotional habits that, and you find that things happen and you're reacting always in the same way. So I, you know, just by, you know, I have certain tendencies towards feeling, say, threatened by certain things, or I used to be, you know, like very frightened of being criticized. Things like this, and people criticizing me or blaming me for things, I really feel angry or upset. So much so that I couldn't, you know, I'd just lose it. I'd have to be in a very controlling position to avoid those kind of scenes, or when confronted, I'd just feel very hurt or very angry. So then, noticing this was a habit of the mind, you know, that it kind of, when somebody criticizes me, then the habit goes, you've been rejected and you're not good enough, and things like this, the inner voice would say. It tends to be self-condemning, a self-disparaging habit. So then listening to this habit, I began to see that it was just that. It didn't have, you know, wasn't no truth to it. It just, even if I was, you know, I realized that no matter what I did, no matter how successful or great I could be, that this voice would still go on saying, you know, you're not good enough and you shouldn't have said that. And you, and it's just a habit of the mind that somehow developed, not intentionally. But so when things go in that way, then I'm aware, you know, so I don't no longer believe in those kind of reactions. And so now, of course, it's the tendencies for that, when you're not feeding them, they fade away. They don't go all at once, but their power is, you've disempowered them. So, you know, things go on and I can hear this, but it doesn't mean anything very much. I don't believe in it anymore. Where at one time, I easily believe it. Get lost for days and feeling, you know, hopeless because the monks were criticizing me and I failed them, and then it wasn't, you know, I should have. Then it goes into this pattern of I was made into a teacher before I was ready, and I had to accept responsibility. I should have had more years of practice behind me. It goes into this pattern, you see. And it says the same thing over and over again. It's pretty boring, ain't it? It's not even original, so you just can't take it seriously if you listen to it. But if you don't listen to it, then it's quite convincing, because it's an emotional thing, and, you know, emotions have this kind of powerful quality when you keep giving them that power, keep empowering them. And then it's like in investigation in Dhamma training, you know, you're seeing anicca, dukkha, anatta, or impermanence and unsatisfactoriness and not self. Just like memories. I have memory. Somebody that's, you know, say somebody that's giving me a rough time in my life that I have a very unpleasant memory of. And so then when the name of this person comes up, and then I feel this, you know, that person really, you know, I feel really, you know, if I attach to that memory, then I can actually believe that memory is the person. But when I really look at it, it's only a memory. It's not a person at all. And yet I can, you know, if I'm not aware, I can just live my life as if my memory is the real person when it's not. There's a kind of dishonesty. So it's like seeing, you know, you're looking at things as they are. Memory's a memory. It's as simple as that. And so a memory is, I remember this person, and that's just a memory. And it comes and goes, and it has no essence to it. You know, when you really look at it, it's like a phantom, like a mist that goes through consciousness. It has nothing that you can get hold of. And just by keep referring to it in that way, the tendency to believe in those, in what those memories bring up, falls away. You know, you're breaking you're breaking through the attachment, the blind attachment to that. I found, you know, in the monastic life, like I, you know, things that have happened to me maybe 40 years ago, unpleasant experiences in life or feeling of betrayal by others and that. And I start thinking of them now, I could make myself, wind myself up with it. Just by remembering those, something happened 40 years ago, and hanging on to it and making it, and winding myself into a state, I can do that if I want, but I don't bother, you know. And yeah, you know, you could see how, if you don't know this, how people, you know, carry things through a whole lifetime, resenting something of their childhood or what, because that's how the mind works. If you, you know, if you don't see through it with wisdom, then you carry it through till your death. Well, this way, you're not denying or suppressing at all. You're acknowledging it is what it is. That's very honest. You know, it's not trying to make out it's something more than that or less. So, like a severe emotional trauma is still a severe emotional trauma. You're not dismissing it by saying, oh, it's only a memory in Nitya, Dukkha, Anatta, kind of pushing it out, because that's an intellectual thing, you know, where you know, it's nothing and dismiss it. But it's willing to actually allow it to be conscious. That's where this openness is recommended, this attitude of receptivity, receiving, listening, allowing something to be what it is. So, like on an emotional experience where very traumatic emotions arise, you're allowing them, you're giving them permission to be what they are, but you're relating to it from an awareness position rather than from an attachment as a self, as a personal thing. But you're not denying its importance. So an important emotional trauma is, important emotional traumas are like this, you know, so it's that your relationship to it is an honest and direct one, an allowing one, not a dismissing or diminishing one. It's hard to describe. It's hard to do, too, I find, because it's... man, we don't like emotions anyway. It's also embarrassing. But still, you know, whether you don't like or don't like your emotions is... When things happen, this is what you're getting, you know. So the Buddha's teaching, like in dependent origination or ittabhajjata, this teaching, when the conditions for this are present, then this is the result. I found that very helpful, because it's easy to, like now, say, the conditions for emotional trauma at this moment are not present. At least at this moment, I don't feel any kind of emotional trauma arising. because the conditions aren't here. But if suddenly something should happen where the conditions appear, you know, it's easy to talk like this when you're, you know, when the conditions aren't here. But when the conditions are here, that's where the sense of trusting in your awareness is so important. Because then it's most valuable when you can begin to just let go of a little, you know, just begin to remind yourself a little more to allow, to notice, to receive, to accept something maybe you don't like at all, or don't have spent your life resisting or fighting against it. Then it's, you know, like life also is poignant. So you know, you feel, you know, the more mindful you are, the more you're aware of the sadness of life. Because in the West, we have a determination to deny this, that if you're healthy, you're happy. Happiness is a sign of good health. So this, we tend to feel guilty and a lot. We complicate everything because of our ideals of what we think should be. But when you contemplate experience, you know, there's always this sense of separation of, you know, the loved and the separation from the loved. And this is, you know, this goes on as a through a lifetime. And the loss, and you see, like your parents get old and die, and your pets and your friends, and and the changing, when things change, you know, maybe you like life like this, and then it changes, and there's this sense of loss when your life changes in a way you find you don't like or don't want. So it's noticing the natural poignancy of the human realm. You know, we have a monastic reflection: all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I remember when I first reflected on that, you know, that's depressing, you know. That's really, you know, all that is mine, beloved, that's really sad. And then I began to see, well, you know, if I attach to it, you know, I don't like that, then... And I don't want to think like that because I want happiness. Maybe I want my monastic life to be just, you know, just experience of unmitigated happiness all the time, you know. Then, but life isn't like that. Monastic life isn't, you know, guaranteeing happiness. You know, we used to think, if I get into this state of samadhi, then I can kind of bypass all the other stuff, you know, kind of get out of it. But that's not what I found. It seems like, you know, monastic life seems to bring to fruition everything, you know, all the stuff you've been trying to run away from. It makes it a strong kind of pounding at the door of consciousness. And where you think, you know, then you think, oh, you know, I joined the monastic life so I could get samadhi and live in a state of purity. And then you find out that it's not what you're getting out of it. That's an ideal again, you know, we'd like that, to be happy and peaceful forever. But it's like some people... You know, Western people are oftentimes condemn Buddhism as being pessimistic and negative, especially Theravada Buddhism, because of emphasis on suffering and that, but because it's a noble truth. But it's, you know, because the suffering is depressing. If that's the absolute truth, yeah, and a kind of miserable fact of life, that's depressing. You know, everything is suffering. Everything's going to leave. You know, I'm going to be separated. All is mine, beloved and pleasing will become otherwise. We're all going to die. What's the point? You know, it's depressing. and then I think maybe I don't like that. So I wonder, life is about love and happiness and fulfilling yourself. That's very inspiring, you know, that lifts the spirit, and the other depresses the spirit. So then what the Buddha's pointing to is recognizing the two extremes. Not that there's anything wrong with either extreme, but the attachment to them blinds us to reality. So then they like I find now, like the monastic life is, the pujas we do, and that, you know, been doing those for 37 years. Namo Tassa Bhagavato. And you get, and at first you, you know, the challenge of memorizing all that, and then learned it in Thai too. So I spent, you know, just the struggling with it and learning it and learning the Thai translations and all that, it kept me kind of interested. Then once it becomes kind of habitual, it can get really boring. So you think, Namo Tassa Bhagavato, it becomes perfunctory and mechanical. But then after a while, as you see the suffering, just relating to it on that level, you see the suffering and just doing it because it's traditional and you feel you have to. But suddenly these words come forth. So suddenly, you know, you understand what Namo Tassa Bhagavato is a reality within you. You know, it's something alive and it's pointing, you know, rather than just some exotic language, some sacred ceremony that you're supposed to do, and you just do it out of, you know, but you aren't experiencing it. And actually through that, you know, as you're open more and more, then you find the blessings of your life. You find your life blessed. And then, what does blessing mean? I've used that word, you know, I use it all the time before, you know, before I was a monk. But what do I mean by blessing? What is the reality of blessing? And then I realized that I'm blessed, you know. I'm experiencing blessings all the time, you know. And I just, as I open to it, I begin to recognize it. It's not that I'm never, that it just is a kind of, you know, one-off occasion every 10 years, but it's, you know, it's a continuous kind of blessing I feel in life. So, And that's through recognizing what's here and now, rather than through creating some kind of fantasy about blessing or just winding myself up into a high around it. So it's like a lot of the structures of a religion, you know, the structures, the conventional structures of religion, they all really are moving us in that direction. You know, through the various symbols and ceremonies that they use. But the danger is always in just either in clinging to the symbol or rejecting it. You know, you're not, it isn't integrating into, it isn't real till you know it for yourself. So like prayers or people ask me if I pray. And somebody today asked me if I, wants me to, a friend of hers is in a terrible kind of fears and anxieties. She's very old. She wants me to pray for her friend, because if this friend knows that I'm praying for, that'll help her a bit. And so, do Buddhist monks pray? Who do we pray to? If you don't believe in God, who do you pray to? These are the questions you get. Because Buddhism, we don't believe in God. So if there's no God, who's going to hear the prayer? Is the logic, isn't it? But it's not. That's another viewpoint. You know, what is belief? What is God? What is prayer? You know, getting into the what we, you know, not just the mundane interpretation of these words, but what are they pointing at in terms of direct experience of reality? So then, you know, you can see how, if you say Buddhists don't believe in God, well, it's one of those things where we don't believe in what generally people mean by God, maybe. But isn't that we don't believe in God either? It's like our faith is moving into a state where we're actually learning to be one with that, with God, you know, in awareness. Rather than believe in some idea of God or some doctrine about God. But then that's a difficult one to describe, because people have very fixed views about there being God is, or there's no God or whatever. But those are viewpoints, you know, whether you believe God is an old man with a white beard up in the sky, or you believe God, there's no God, it's still, you don't know what you're talking about. You're just working on a very on the level of thought, you know, rational thinking. So in terms of reality, say we use the word the deathless, amata dhamma, I remember. People have criticized me for talking about nirvana too much, or the deathless, because to people that's just an abstract word. Because you can't visualize deathlessness, you know. So when you, or nirvana, what nirvana sounds like it used to be described as extinction. So then when I first went to Thailand, I say, what do Buddhists believe in Nibbana? So I mean, what does Nibbana mean? It means the extinction. And so it sounds like annihilation, you know, I just make myself extinct. Which is, you know, on an emotional level isn't a very attractive experience, you know. It sounds so negative. You know, I'm just practicing in order to not exist, really. But up with it all, and that's what Buddhists do, and that can be, you know, rather. And some people might like that, you know, the kind of hopelessness of it all and meaningless of life can be, you know, find that quite the, you know, their cup of tea, really. But others are, you know, find that just too unbearable. So it's not, you know, the Bodhisattva ideal of helping and for the welfare of all sentient beings is more inspiring. It's an inspiring attitude. But if you, with awareness, you transcend both of those attitudes towards the reality of deathlessness. So what is it as reality? As if it's just an abstract idea. Well, I mean, because, you know, you can't try to make an image of the deathless. They're usually zero or something, blank screen. Or, you know, it tends towards annihilation as a logical thing. Or eternal life is more inspiring, you know. Fullness of life and eternity of life is you put in positive terms, and that inspires the mind. But the awareness of negation, of annihilation, or inspiration, what is that? You know, so you begin to notice awareness. You're beginning to recognize awareness is like this. It's not high, it's not low, and it can allow both. It can allow annihilation and inspiration in the same, everything belongs. So then you've got perspective. You see, begin to see things in perspective. Then the reality of the deathless, to me, is very strong. You know, it's not like a delicate moment that comes only in specially refined meditation experiences. But once it's recognized, once you realize that, then it's real. It's a fact. It's not a kind of delicate mental experience at all. But it's also recognizing it, because this is why I emphasize learning to trust this awareness, because emotionally we don't trust ourselves very much, and emotions are not trustworthy. So then you think, well, so maybe you're just deluding yourself. maybe you're just, one of these vipalat bhikkhus, these kind of crazy bhikkhus that drive themselves into madness, called vipalat bhikkhus. and so I know you, vipalat bhikkhus. And it's not that I'm, can claim anything personally, but there's an incredible amount of trust in the awareness that has developed through recognizing this. You know, so it's very simple. It's not like a miracle or a magic, but it's very real and strong. So that what happens, in terms of my own experience of life, is accepted in this perspective. And that's what else have you got when you really think of it? Like Lungpa Cha, great teacher. He died. Buddhadatta, great, he died. They all died on me. My preceptor died last year. And then, Buddha died. And so forth. So in terms of, it's easy to project onto somebody else, too. Like I found with my relationship to Ajahn Chah was, a need to have somebody there who I respected and could trust in. So then, and he fulfilled that role very well. But then his approach was always bringing me back into what I'm actually doing. So if I'm clinging to him, I'm aware, I'm beginning to see what I'm doing, projecting onto him things, or expecting all kinds of things from him, or how one does when you have a teacher you really admire, and then you project all kinds of things onto him. So instead of saying you shouldn't project anything onto me, he could get me to see what I was doing in the relationship with him. I found that very valuable. Because at the end of the day, this is what we can trust, is awareness. That he died. So if he pointed to himself, saying, "I'm your teacher, and I will guide you through," I've been happy to go along with it. because you know, at one point it'd been easier, you know, to trust him than myself. But because of his constant reference back to this awareness, it, you know, it became very, you know, I began to see how, you know, what I was doing. Because then I could also see if I was develop my soul faith in another person like Lumpur Cha, then I could also feel let down when he didn't live up to my expectations, or I thought he didn't live up to them, or, you know, or he, you know, I could feel disappointed or critical of him because my projections were very kind of demanding, you know, him to be perfect for me. So I could begin to see that it's a creating, how I created that. And so more and more, just by getting to the source of it, I could stop doing that. I no longer, you know, wanted, you know, once I saw the suffering of doing that, I stopped doing it. So it's like just these Sunday talks are mainly to encourage. I hope they're doing that. Yes. Yes. Well, to be an honest lawyer, well, you have to establish standards like the laws of the country and, you know, and everyone can be cynical about lawyers, but it isn't, that doesn't help. But they recognizing that in a legal system, like laws are what society agrees to live by. So that, in terms of behavior. So then, and that the ethics and is very important. But then, as so much of law has become now, it's manipulative and you know, it knows how to turn things to manipulate emotions and how to conquer somebody else through reason and whatnot, proof, facts, and statistics, and evidence. So it, you know, this means that it's that the ethical value is with some lawyers isn't very strong. But because it's important to win a case to make the money, and the idea is so much of the modern sense of success is not on how you do it, but whether you win or lose. So this is the society we live in. You know, its ethical sense is badly damaged, and you can see it in sports now. And it's winning that's important, and making the money, getting the big salary, and that. So it's the society, this is what our society has turned into. And once those things are more important, then ethics goes out the window. Ethics is a means if you can make more money by being ethical, not because you're committed to it. But like ethics is, you know, a human existence. We agree on how we're going to live with each other. So just to make life bearable. So, you know, first precept, refrain from intentionally killing other humans, is a moral agreement. It's ethical. We agree to that. So then, how many people live up to it? You know, we're quite willing to go and shoot down Al-Qaeda and, you know, kill off Islamic fundamentalists and things like this. We're quite, you know, there's no moral problem, doesn't be a moral problem at all. But if they took Bhanadivata seriously, like a Buddhist monk, we couldn't do that. You know, even if Osama bin Laden came in here with a rifle, like, I wouldn't shoot him. Well, if I had a rifle, I would. At least that's a theory anyway. But one values the ethical side. Then you're building up a level of trust in a community, because like in the like here at Amaravati, there's a high level of trust here because people have a strong sense of responsibility for their conduct here. So it's not, you don't have to worry about a lot of things. Where if you're living in London or something, you know, it's much more kind of burglar alarms and you can't trust the neighbors or anything, you know, so you've got to take all kinds of precautions because the ethical nature of society is no longer the important issue. And you can see internationally, like Israel and Palestine, whereas there's no sense of ethics involved of the value of human life, or Bhanadibata, not intentionally killing another human being. If it's if it's the enemy, you kill him. It's not a valuing the life of a human being, but giving the right to kill, an encouragement to kill your enemy. Well, how can you trust then? You know, you end up with what's going on in Israel at this time. You know, where everybody, or in Iraq, where everybody's trying to shoot at each other. It's because there's no common agreement on the level of ethical behavior. And yet, the Americans, Bush is determined that he's, God's on his side, and the Islamic terrorists are, you know, being, you know, committing suicide, you know, in the name of Allah. So, I mean, they're both righteous. And they're both doing it for God. But there's no, on the level of ethics, it doesn't work. You know, they don't agree on the basic thing. You don't have to believe in God, and then we can agree not to kill each other. You and I can, we can learn to live together, even if you don't believe in Buddha, and I do. You know, I'm not going to kill you because you don't believe in Buddha. Because the ethic is more important to me than making you believe what I do. So it's, monastery, it's, you know, you realize how, you know, what a good community does. It gives, it's a lot you just don't have to think about because of there's a lot you can take for granted on that sense, on the ethical sense. But then the problems in monastic life get more complicated. you're not into, you know, threatening each other with guns or knives, but but we can, you know, we get even more sensitive, you know, feel what you said to me the other day really wounded me. So then learning, you know, developing right speech. And so it's interesting here how the community, because it's so many different cultures living together. You've got Asian monks and Asian nuns and Europeans and Americans, and there's so much difference. Just between Americans and the British, totally different species. And so, you know, just the behavior is so different that there's a lot of misunderstanding just on level of way an American will say something. And then, you know, you're kind of aware of how you even, your thoughts can be quite aggressive even though you don't mean to be. So I can sound aggressive even though I have no intention of sounding like that. So it's learning to learn to listen to each other more. So you're aware of how what I say, how it's affecting you. So and then if I give you the, you know, ask you to give feedback. If what I say really upsets you, you know, I may not know that unless you tell me. So there's a kind of willingness to listen to each other and try to understand each other rather than just form reactions. So it's wonderful in its own way, but it's so, you know, you realize what being sensitive is really about. Life was much easier when I was a coarse male. When I was an insensitive bloke. So I think, yes.
As I'm sure you're aware, the government under Tony Blair has opened up government policy to input from faith-based organizations. Now I wondered, have you or other people in the Buddhist community responded? And I'd be very interested in what you have responded, or if perhaps you might respond in perhaps an overview here. One thing that particularly gets home to me as being very relevant to be brought into the mainstream is developing the concept of the quality of mindfulness, and that this is something that could be very easily introduced to schools without treading on anybody's religious sensitivities, and things like the walking meditation, again, something that could really help to center people, and again, without treading on any sensitivities. And I just would be very interested in this sort of feedback going into the government from people like your good self.
How would one do it?
Well, I mean, they have opened it up. I'd be happy to talk later, but they have opened up this initiative to input into government policy. It's very, very specific to faith-based organizations. But we could perhaps talk afterwards.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, like mindfulness it needn't be labeled. It's So it is, you know, there is a lot of interest. I mean, there's like a lot of schools, they bring the students here and for religious education. And there's a good deal of tolerance and an interest in Britain. You know, I've been amazed myself how tolerant it is here on the religion. But I don't, you know, I do feel, you're right, that there is Buddhism has a lot to offer without becoming proselytizing or threatening to other religions. Because it's not a belief system, so you don't, like we have this retreat center, and people come from Catholic, Roman Catholic monasteries or Anglican places, or, you know, from, they don't have to give up their religion to go on a Buddhist meditation retreat. And they're not, you know, we're not asking them to believe in Buddha or anything, but we're the main point is this awakening them to, and trusting in awareness to even develop their own faith more freely, you know, more skillfully than just, you know, people get into a rut with the conventions that they have. So then this mindfulness opens up ways of getting beyond the kind of habitual practices that easily form around religious ceremonies or religious life.